Hey, welcome along. It is 4 p.m. Eastern Time in North America. That means it's 5 p.m. in the Canadian Maritimes, 5:30 p.m. in Tucker Carlson's favorite fishing grounds of Labrador, and beyond the Americas, it's 9 p.m. in London, 10 p.m. in Paris, 11 p.m. in Jerusalem, and the wee small hours. If you're in Asia, Australia, and the Pacific. But wherever you are, we're glad to have you along with us for another hour of live questions from Mark Stein Club members all around the world. One thing before we get started, of note to our Antipodean members, on Sunday morning, I'm going to be on The Outsiders on Sky News Australia. Glad to be back on that. they get through an awful lot of hosts on that show, but I think Rowan's still with them. He's survived the periodic massacres they have down there. It's a bloodbath in Aussie media. There's so much blood on the floor, but Rowan is still standing, and whoever his current co-hosts will be by Sunday, I'll be thrilled to join them. And we're going to be talking about, as far as I'm aware, we're going to be talking about the Attorney General of the United States' trips to foreign capitals. He's been to London, he's been to Rome, he's been to Canberra to find out what contribution Allied intelligence agencies made to the so-called counterintelligence operation that was being run against the Trump campaign. Very interesting, if you regard it as I do, as an attempted coup, to learn about the role that MI6 in London and ASIO Down Under and other parties may have played in it. So we will get to that Sunday morning in Oz. I think it's complicated. I can barely figure out Australian time as it is. It's further complicated by the fact that they changed their clocks this weekend, and they spring into summer rather than fall back to winter, because that's the southern hemisphere and this is the northern hemisphere. But I believe it's 9 a.m. Sydney time, which is sort of Saturday where I am in New Hampshire. Actually, it may already have happened. I may already have done the show and not even know about it. But I think it's actually around, if you're interested in trying to watch from North America, I think it's around kind of 6 p.m. Saturday night, Eastern time in America. But for our Australian viewers, Outsiders on Sky News Australia, Sunday morning, very much looking forward to that. Our first question today comes from Chris Hall, our favorite Macedonian content farmer. He and his fellow Macedonian content farmers cost Hillary the election, and they're proud of it. They're shameless. But Chris, Macedonian content farmer, writes, "Hey, Mark, I'd very much like to hear about your trip to Hillsdale. This summer, Mrs. Macedonian content farmer and I drove to Hillsdale, and we thought it was a cute little campus. It's a little off the beaten path, though, but maybe that's a feature, not a bug. But first, a quick question. I always thought that Mike Pence scared progressives even more than Orange Man Bad does. But with the Dems pulling out all the stops and producing at least one whistleblower per week, they seem to be serious about impeachment. Do you think they've thought through the implications of a President Pence, or will they try to pull a maneuver like that used in your not-favourite movie, Dave? That is to drop the presidential scandal onto the VP and go for a twofer. Don't do any plot spoilers. There may be people who like Dave. Dave was that Kevin Kline movie. It was the lamest ever remake of The Prisoner of Zender, basically, where Kevin Kline plays both this sort of, I guess, George Bush Sr. type president and his alleged lookalike. But it's a very wan affair, I think. The point about, and you're right, because Mike Pence ought to terrify them in idea. If it was about ideology, someone like Trump, who's basically a decadent, debauched New Yorker. I'm not making any criticisms here. They're all like that in Midtown Manhattan. It's just the general run of the population. Versus Mike Pence, who's supposedly Mr. Hardcore, scary, evangelical, social conservative. He wants the gays to all burn in hell. He's a man who takes his commitment to ushering in Margaret Atwood's Handmaid's Tale so seriously that, as Greg Gutfeld joked, he's a guy who won't even be alone with his own wife. In theory, if you were just talking about this in ideological terms, Trump is obviously the guy they can work with, and Pence is the serious nutso, out of control, social conservative, evangelical, homophobe guy that is just way off the charts for them. So why are they trying to get Trump removed from office to install Pence? Well, first, Nancy Pelosi is a lot of things, but she's not deluded. And Nancy Pelosi's object in this impeachment theater is not to remove Trump from office. She doesn't think that's going to happen. But she thinks that impeachment energizes the base. So while impeachment isn't going to result in the removal of the president from office, it might result in the Democrats taking the Senate and the presidency if their base gets energized, which so far, frankly, it isn't. And for that reason, that counts for more with her than whoever Mike Pence is, particularly if you figured that you're not going to remove the guy from office. But let's say all the chips fell their way and they actually succeeded in impeaching Trump in the House and getting him convicted in the Senate and therefore removing him from office. That would count for way more in their terms than installing Mike Pence in the Oval Office. That would be that they would pay that price in order to demonstrate their power. And they would be teaching a powerful lesson. The Democrats want the Republicans to carry on nominating decent losers like Mitt Romney, John McCain. I heard Molly Hemingway this week give a fabulous address at Hillsdale in which she said that basically Republican voters got sick of being asked to nominate a guy who could give a decent concession speech. Remember John McCain? John McCain said he was proud to lose to Barack Obama. That could serve as the concession speech for all the Republicans, for Bob Dole in 96, for McCain in 08, I'm proud to lose to this man. For Mitt Romney in 2012, I'm proud to lose to this man. You could see Jeb Bush. Can you just imagine the kind of concession speech Jeb Bush would... Oh, it would have been wonderful. What a shame. What a shame Trump came along and denied us the opportunity to hear the fabulous concession speech that Jeb Bush would have made in November 2016. Oh, it would have been marvelous. And so they're teaching a lesson here. Republicans, you stick with the guys who know how to give a nice, decent, dignified concession speech. But if you nominate a guy and you elect a guy like Trump ever again, we're going to remove him from office. And that would signal their awesome power far more than whether Mike Pence gets to sit in the Oval Office himself for 6 weeks or 2 months or whoever's left. And that's important to them. That's serious. That's important to them, Chris. Actually, I'll tell you what, Chris, you did mention my trip to Hillsdale. I've been in Hillsdale the last few days in Michigan, Hillsdale College, for their 175th birthday. And we'll just say a quick word about it because Molly Hemingway gave an excellent speech. So did Victor Davis Hanson. Marvelous speech. And the big highlight of the trip was the dedication of the new Christ Chapel on the campus, right on one side of the quad. It sort of filled in a gap they had, is really a marvelous thing. And they had Clarence Thomas from the United States Supreme Court in to dedicate that. And Pat Sajak, whom you know from Wheel of Fortune, Pat is also has his serious side, and he's very committed to Hillsdale, and he loves that place. He was there as well. We all had a grand old time. It was the first classical chapel built in the United States since one was commissioned at Boston University in 1920. So basically a century ago. They didn't finish that one at Boston University until 1950. They took their time over it. That's 70 years ago. So this is basically the first classical chapel in architectural style built in America in three quarters of a century. And as Larry Ahn, the president of Hillsdale, said, the question is not why we decided to build this, but why no other institutions around the country have decided to build a classical chapel. It's a beautiful building. And the sound, the dedication service, and Clarence Thomas spoke, and there were many fine elements to it. But the first hymn was Hubert Parry's great anthem, "I Was Glad When They Said Unto Me." It's super Anglican, but in the best sense, not in the, you know, the modish gay bishop who likes fellas playing folk songs on guitar sense. It's the best kind of Anglicanism, the Hubert Parry anthem. And the sound of the Hillsdale Choir and those voices wafting up into the great dome was absolutely beautiful. So it was a terrific couple of days, and it reminds one that in an insane educational environment, there is at least one lone beacon of sanity. And I was very glad to be there with Clarence Thomas and with Pat Sajak and Molly and Victor and all the rest of the gang. A great honor and a great privilege. Elizabeth Castle writes, I'm curious what you think is in store from Trump once he's done with his presidency. Let's say 2024. He doesn't need to cozy up to anyone to secure wealth, though he might close a deal. And he doesn't strike me as a man who will happily forget the vitriol slung his way. Do you have any insight on whether his character leans toward vengeful? I often wonder if the entirety of the political class forgets they'll have Trump as a private citizen with whom to contend. Or should we suppose their hatred of him descends into willingness to destroy his entire life? We've certainly seen it happen to several during the Mueller fiasco. There's a Russian reversal joke, if ever I've seen one. Actually, you know, one of the things I think that's interesting about President Trump is that he seems to me quite a secure person. And I think there's a different... let's put it this way. He didn't get to be where he is by being the cartoon that they represent him as. For example, Twitter. He goes on Twitter and he trolls people. I've said, you can look at it in different ways. The analogy I used was one after they had this story out of Florida a few months back where people were going to bed and a cockroach would crawl into their ear canal during the night and lay eggs inside your head as you slept. So you wake up in the morning and the cockroach has laid all these eggs inside you. And that's what Trump does on Twitter. He wakes up, he starts tweeting, and in effect, he's crawled into the media's head and laid, the Trump roach has laid a little bunch of eggs in there each morning. Trump does that as strategy. He trolls people as strategy. He trashes people as strategy because it's necessary to do that to break through an utterly corrupt and disgusting and worthless garbage American media that has behaved actually disgracefully and has never asked itself the big question why it completely blew. If it was a serious media, the first thing they would have done on Wednesday morning in November 2016 is, how the hell did we get this thing so wrong? We need to calmly step back and look at our biases and examine why we were so out of touch with the mood of the nation that we assumed that Hillary was a shoo-in and this guy was a joke who had no chance. And they didn't do that. They didn't do that. And he's president and your guy, Hillary, isn't. Because you blew it and you got it wrong. And why is that? Well, why don't you think about it this way, that he is the Trump roach laying his little eggs in your brain each night, and so you wake up stark staring nuts. The real Trump, it seems to me, from a limited acquaintance with him, but also from talking to people who know him very well, that Trump has constructed a public persona that is necessary, because it's of a size that can bust through the absolute appalling, fraudulent nature of the American media in its reporting of the political scene. We just saw a particularly egregious example this week in which Adam Schiff, the so-called guy who's going to investigate the integrity of the president, Adam Schiff on the House Intelligence Committee, actually lied. Even the Washington Post, in their stupid measurement political lies thing, gave him the full four Pinocchios for what he said when he denied that he'd known the whistleblower or communicated with the whistleblower before the whistleblower blew the whistle. A lie. A flat-out lie. So we're supposed to take impeachment inquiry serious from the liar, from the guy who, because the actual transcript of the Ukraine phone call is so boring and unexceptional, has to do a so-called satire, a so-called parody of the phone call instead. The media are still in the tank for Schiff. So only Trump on Twitter can actually... Trump in character has to have that size to bust through it. And I think that's very interesting. But it's different from who he is in real life. And when he eventually leaves the White House and, like Cincinnatus, returns to his farm, or in this case, Cincinnatus returning to his casino, whatever it is. I think he'll be relatively relaxed about all that. He'll have vanquished his enemies. He will have made it just like, for example, he gets on well with Ted. He mocked Ted. He demanded to know what Ted Cruz's father was doing on the grassy knoll. And then after that, he's perfectly fine with Lion Ted. He's perfectly fine. He's had his difficulties with Mitt Romney, and then he toyed with Mitt Romney as a cat toys with a mouse by inviting him for dinner at Trump Tower and dangling the Secretary of State's gig in front of him. And he's actually a very clever and in fact. Relatively relaxed and terribly secure person about a lot of that stuff. Cross Border Gal writes, very concerned about an anti-free speech issue brewing at the University of Washington. You may have gotten wind of it already, but in case not, wanted you to know about it. Many thanks. This actually is an interesting one, because as you know, I'm being sued by a FACO climate plaintiff, Michael Mann, the inventor of the climate change hockey stick. He just lost catastrophically, totally. He lost his case at the British Columbia Supreme Court, and he's been ordered to pay Dr. Timbal's costs, which apparently stack up to about $700,000 US. Tim isn't going to be getting all that from him, but he's going to be getting a six-figure sum out of Michael Mann. So Michael Mann can go around bleating that he hasn't really lost and Ball hasn't really won. But when you're the guy writing the seven-figure check, the guy you're writing the six-figure check to is the winner, and the guy who's writing the six-figure check is the loser. But this case in Washington is a climate change case. In Oregon, they want to pass this big sort of carbon tax. And they've got a member of staff there who writes a climate blog, and he's in favor of carbon taxes, but he's not in favor of this carbon tax because he thinks it's regressive, that the burdens of the Oregon carbon tax, if it passes, will fall on the poorest in societies. That's carbon taxes all over, by the way. The whole all these climate change amelioration taxes and proposals are designed to keep the poor poor. It's a boutique niche issue for upper middle class white privileged people, a way for them to screw over the rest of the planet and prevent them from ever living the way they do. That's the essence of it. Anyway, he's in favour of carbon taxes, just not in favour of this one. And meanwhile, you have all the big shots, the head of the whatever it is, the Earth Sciences Department and all the rest of it, who are all gung-ho for this carbon tax because they like all these carbon taxes. And half the faculty have also signed letters and written to the newspapers and taken out ads saying, we love this carbon tax on behalf of the University of Washington, which is a public institution. He said he was opposed to it, and he said this was just the usual thing where it was going to be, it was basically a bunch of privileged upper-middle-class climate activists getting affairs arranged to their benefit. And he illustrated it with a picture of pigs at a trough, which is a universal political analogy for when you have a system where there's cronyism and the cronies are on the take. They immediately responded that obviously he's being racist because amongst all the upper middle class whites bleating for this carbon tax, there's three blacks and a couple of Hispanics and maybe a Muslim. And so this picture of pigs at the trough is deeply racist. And the university has now stepped in and is actually trying to control private social media accounts of people who work for the university. And they're not going to get anywhere on that. It's a publicly funded university. And even in crazy land, even in the United States of America in 2019, you can't do that. So the minute this comes up before a judge, even a judge in the Ninth Circus, as Rush likes to call them, this is going to go nowhere. But it is a big free speech issue, and it's basically part of the what is one of the most unattractive features of universities these days, where a place that was founded for open, honest inquiry is saying no on this subject and that subject and another 37 subjects. There's no honest, open inquiry. There's the party line. And the president and the dean and the provost and all these other people, they lay down the party line and you have to follow it. That's a lot of things. That's a lot of things to make a good one-party state, make a good old-school trades union, but it's not a university. It's the opposite of a university. And this blogger out there, he's resisting it. And if it ever comes to court, the university will lose. But it shouldn't even be getting that far. Michael Seth writes, Mark, apropos your recent post recalling Europeans as the sick men of Europe, I believe that American Democrats are the sick men of America. Is there a cure for such a lethal virus, or is this simply one of those super STDs you warned us about? That's the new lethal strain of gonorrhea that will happen if you get a no-deal Brexit without an Irish backstop. You need a backstop. If you don't have an Irish backstop, you're at severe risk of getting infected with the super gonorrhea. That's the official position of Project Fear in the United Kingdom. I'd suggest truth serum for starters, but the cockroaches of the deep state are surely immune. Can a two-party system function with only one loyal party? What's your prognosis? Thanks. Well, I think we are, actually. When I wrote about this, Michael is referencing a column I posted to mark the passing of Jacques Chirac, a Gallic charmer. I greatly admired him as one of the most impressive legover merchants in the European continent. That hottie that Junior Assad is married to in Syria. He put the moves on her when they were visiting the Elysee Palace a few years ago. Assad had gone to bed early and Chirac wasted no time making his move. He was an impressive figure in that respect, if in no other. But I posted my old 2002 column in which what was meant to be a presidential election between Chirac, I think I described him, and his prime minister, Lionel Jospin. They were competing together for the presidency. And Jospin was a man who is left of right of left of centre, and Chirac was a man who was right of left of right of left of centre. And I call them Euro-D and Euro-Dumb. There's actually no choice between them. Their worldview is identical. It doesn't really make any difference. And the French people decided they wanted a choice. And so instead of Chirac and Jospin in the election, it wound up being Chirac and Jean-Marie Le Pen, the father of Marine Le Pen, who has since gone on to even greater success than her dad could ever have dreamed of. Because people want a choice. The more the establishment says, no, no, we're narrowing the bounds within which you can discuss politics. So it's Euro-D and Euro-Dumb. And it's no choice at all. That's actually the same to which American politics had dwindled down to 14 years after I wrote my column, when the establishment told us, hey, the 2016 election's coming up. Hope you're excited about it. We really are excited about it. We think it's going to be just a thrilling race. You'll be hooked on this drama for the next 18 months. Hillary versus Jeb. Who isn't excited about that? It's the wife of the previous guy versus the brother and son of the previous guy. That's your choice. And it was a joke. It was a joke. And the American people demanded a different kind of choice, which is how it wound up being Trump versus Hillary. But it's still Euro-D and Euro-Dumb, or whatever you want to call it here, Yankee-D and Yankee-Dumb, whatever you want to call it. And Michael says, can a two-party system function with only one loyal party? I think that's actually an optimistic way of looking at it, Michael. I think one of the problems, and I think it has emerged in the never-Trump forces, is that I don't want to just quote Molly Hemingway for the full hour, but she did give an absolutely cracking presentation yesterday. And one of the points she made, she was talking about Putin. Putin has an opposition, so-called, in the Duma in Moscow. And the crude dictators have a one-party state. The wilier fellows have controlled opposition. They're people who are nominally the opposition, and they're allowed to win a few seats in the parliament and thereby accumulate some power and influence for themselves and some perks for themselves. But the deal is that they never seriously question what Putin's doing, and therefore are never any kind of real threat to what he's doing or what he wants to do. And that is, in effect, what we have wound up with in the so-called conservative movement, which is barely capable of moving anything. We've got this incredibly expensive infrastructure of magazines and think tanks and all the rest of it as I often say, always insists that whatever issue you're just whether it's whatever it is never the hill to die on. And so one by one, you lose all the hills, and the controlled opposition, as Putin would call it, never seriously challenges that or rolls any of it back. I was asked a question when I spoke about the Federal Department of Education, which Jimmy Carter set up, and it's basically to ensure that the teachers' unions have their own government department and their own seat at the cabinet table, in effect. It does nothing for education. And the Republicans have been pledging to get rid of it in their platform since 1980. And they never have got rid of it. They've never moved to get rid of it. They never will get rid of it. It's all just, you know, it's a dinner theatre, third-rate dinner theatre at that. I don't mind good dinner theatre. I don't mind you go and see Tony Danza in South Pacific, that's good dinner theatre. But this is lousy dinner theatre, and that's all it is. And so it's not just it's when you say can a two-party system function with only one loyal party, Michael? The more interesting question is can a two-party system function when only one party is serious about power. The Republicans, the biggest issue of the last decade, which is Obamacare, which was shoved down the throats of the American people on a purely partisan basis, even after Scott Brown had won the election for Ted Kennedy's seat in Massachusetts. So then what happens is the Tea Party movement comes along and Republicans take the House. And everyone says, okay, so you're going to get rid of Obamacare. Oh, no, we've only got the House. You'd need to give us the Senate. Next election, they take the Senate. Okay, well, now you got the Senate. So are we going to get rid of Obamacare? Oh, no. You don't understand how it works. You need the House, the Senate, and the White House. Okay, so 2016 happens, and one party controls the House, the Senate, and the White House. So where is this repeal of Obamacare that you've been telling us you were going to do since 2009? Where is it? Where's your plan? The plans you supposedly had, the plans you raised money off. Look, I'm a foreigner and I wake up every morning to all these bleatings from various Republican groups of one kind or another, PACs and think tanks. Give us your money. Give us all your money right now and then we'll repeal Obamacare. That's what they said for years and years and years and years. And then when they controlled everything, it turned out they had no plan. They weren't serious. They weren't serious. And the other guys are serious. That's the difference. Robert Stewart says, Mark, what is your expectation for Brexit? Will the demigods in black robes allow it to occur? Well, first, Bob, let me say this. The demigods in black robes are my pal Clarence Thomas and the other fellas on the US Supreme Court. If you've seen judges in the UK or Canada or other parts of the Commonwealth, you know they have the big ermine collars and the red robes. That's what I like in a judge. The black robes, black robes are fine for the barristers, but like a judge, I like in a big red robe. As it happens, this UK Supreme Court is an utterly which basically told Boris Johnson, well, actually didn't tell Boris Johnson, told the Queen that the Queen had prorogued Parliament illegally. These judges don't wear any kinds of robes at all. In fact, Lady Hale, who delivered the decision, was wearing some wacky dress of hers with that strange spider brooch on that suddenly became a huge hit. It's a modish Tony Blair invention, this so-called Supreme Court, a sort of semi-American-type court that has given here a semi-American-type decision. The question now is whether Boris he's got to be Houdini to get out of the traps that his own party, the opposition parties, the Speaker of the House of Commons, and these wretched, stinking, miserable joke jurists on the UK Supreme Court have made for him. If he's to get out of the European Union by October 31st. Now, this very day in London, they're all terribly excited because they found some bit of government paperwork that suggests that Boris is planning to ask Brussels for an extension to this October 31st deadline, whereas just a couple of weeks ago he was saying he'd rather die in a ditch than ask for an extension of the Brexit deadline of October 31st. I'm not sure when I look at these particular traps that have been arranged for him. I do know that in Europe, for an extension to be granted would require whatever it is, 27 other countries all to approve that extension. So in a sense, he only has to find one to nix it, and he would be in a bound, he would be free. everyone, the conventional wisdom in London is that he's been slightly outmaneuvered on that. My view is this, that if it comes to a second referendum or an election which is not fought on conventional left-right issues, but is fought on Boris's current slogan, "Get Brexit Done," then the pro-Brexit forces would prevail. Right now, the danger of this Supreme, awful Supreme Court decision, which actually I don't want to get into the constitutional question, but in a sense is a license for absolute monarchy, apart from anything else. But this awful Supreme Court decision, where you keep telling the people that the basic law, the first law now, it's like the first, if Britain had a written constitution, which it doesn't, and instead it's living under basically a joke regime of pseudo-law made by the Lady Hale and her wretched, miserable, worthless colleagues. But if Lady Hale ever did get to write the constitution she's purporting to uphold, the very first paragraph, the very first clause will be, "There shall be no Brexit." That's it. That's the only law that matters. The question is whether Boris can get out of the box they're putting him in. Robert also adds about the corruption and evil within the Department of Justice. Will Barr be able to shovel out this stable? I have no idea. I've had total contempt for federal justice for years, Robert, as if you read me, you well know, this horrible thing it's not just Michael Flynn, it's not a partisan thing. Martha Stewart is a big Hillary backer and a big Hillary supporter, big conventional Democrat views on almost any subject you care to raise with her. But Martha Stewart should still not have gone to jail for lying to the FBI in a matter for which there was no underlying crime. I said at the time that I think that law is horrible. The law of misremembering to the FBI is horrible. We have a situation now where the highest people in the FBI, not field agents all over the country can go rogue here and there, and then they run it up to head office, and head office says, "Whoa, you guys are getting a bit carried away on this stuff." That's the point of head office. Head office exists to tamp down. When you're a field agent working on a case, you always think this case is the greatest thing ever. And it's some guy in head office who just looks at it a bit more dispassionately and says, "This is going nowhere. You need to ease up on this." What we had here was head office gone rogue at the FBI. We have then senior figures in the Department of Justice who have gone rogue, who are talking about wearing a wire to wiretap the president and kick him out under the 25th Amendment. That's not something that the Department of Justice or the FBI does. That's something a physician does. That's something the president's wife does. The president's wife is supposed to say, "My husband had a stroke this morning and he's not making a lot of sense." It's not something. The 25th Amendment does not exist for the FBI, the CIA, or any of the other alphabet soup guys. It's more basic than that. So I think the Department of Justice is corrupt. I think it's so systemically corrupt, and I would include the Bureau of Prisons after what happened with Jeffrey Epstein, where Barr's solution is that the FBI should investigate the Bureau of Prisons. Oh, great. Maybe the Bureau of Prisons then can investigate the FBI. This is a fundamentally corrupt Department of Justice over fundamentally corrupt agencies and bureaus within it. And Barr has, someone has to clean it up, and someone has to clean it out. Owen Morgan writes, "Justin in blackface. Mammy!" That's my Justin Trudeau impression. Mammy! Justin in blackface. Is embarrassing, of course. Should I do Mammy again? I want him to serenade Rosemary Barton, dear old Rosie Barton, with "Rosie, you are my posy, Mammy." Justin in blackface is embarrassing, of course. But shouldn't Canadians be more bothered by the way Trudeau and Scheer both invoke the police to prevent questioning by the press or anyone else at carefully stage-managed election meetings. Not that the rest of us have any reason to feel proud. An English tribunal criminalized the idea that male and female are biological fact, while the New York Times ran a piece entitled "Free Speech is Killing Us," or "Are We Killing Free Speech?" Indeed, the New York Times, basically American legal standards in the modern era on free speech were set by the New York Times in the Sullivan case in the mid-60s. They're now saying, take that away from us, because it's fine for us to have free speech in New York Times and Sullivan, but everybody else using the New York Times standard is going to kill people. Now, you mentioned the Canadian situation. Justin Trudeau, our friend Andrew Lawton. Many of you know Andrew Lawton from his contributions at Stein Online. If you've been on a Mark Stein cruise, you will know him as one of the panelists we have on the cruise. If you came along to see me when I was in Reading, Pennsylvania, and Rochester, New York, and various other places earlier this year, Andrew's actually the guy who does the introductory announcement before I walk out on stage. Andrew was physically prevented and physically removed from Justin Trudeau's meetings. And Andrew Scheer, the supposed Conservative Party leader, then kicked out David Menzies, interviewed me after I testified to the House of Commons Justice Committee a couple of months ago, and he interviewed me. He was now a Conservative Party leader, actually had that guy arrested. I think it was by the Mounties, detained by the Mounties, and removed from the meeting. Both these things are wrong. Andrew Lawton just announced earlier he's been excluded from the Canadian leadership debates, which are being run disgracefully, in my view, by David Johnston, Her Majesty's former Viceroy in Ottawa, which is exactly why he shouldn't be engaging in the political act of determining who attends leaders' debates. You're a former Viceroy, your so-called excellency. Get your viceregal butt out of this. That's not something that someone who speaks in loco Her Majesty should be doing. It's just totally inappropriate. Back off out of here, you viceregal twit. So he shouldn't be on that commission. And he's booted Andrew out of covering the leaders' debates. Andrew is actually suing. I don't know who he is suing, just the leadership, the leaders' debates commissions? Is he suing the Dominion of Canada? Is he suing the Queen? Lawton versus the Queen? Is that how it'll be when it winds up in Ontario Superior Court? Oh, it's in federal court. I think it's in federal court on Monday. If we can find out where it is, maybe we can go along and cover it. But he's going to be in court on Monday. Lawton versus the Queen. That's what it's come down to. This is all quite disgraceful. And in particular, what's interesting about this is that we now see Andrew Scheer has no commitment to free speech, none whatsoever, any more than David Cameron and Theresa May did in the United Kingdom, or I regret to say that George Brandis and, alas, Tony Abbott as Prime Minister did when it came to getting rid of 18C in Australia. And as Owen has noted, we are killing free speech around the world. Tony Blair wants to actually ban political parties who are not violent, who have caused no violence. No violence has been committed in their name, but they just happen to have policies that he doesn't approve of. They want to restrict mass immigration, for example. I want to restrict mass immigration. No country in the world needs mass immigration. It's calculated already in the United States, I think, that 20 million jobs have been lost to automation. So why do we think we need to bring in millions more people to do jobs, most of which won't exist in 10 or 15 years? It's perfectly legitimate to actually question the rationale for mass immigration, but not to Tony Blair, not to Andrew Scheer either. And it is disquieting to me that so-called conservatives, Scheer here, George Brandis down in Australia, Theresa May and David Cameron in London, have absolutely no commitment to it. And very few people want to. Free speech isn't one of the. It's not like in whatever you think about abortion, for example. If you have a pro-life rally, it is an issue that people feel viscerally about. And if you announce a pro-life rally, people will be there in huge numbers. They feel passionately and strongly about it. And free speech in that sense has far fewer friends. And I deeply regret that. But we are losing free speech. And if we lose free speech, the more we say that David Menzies can't attend a meeting by the Conservative Party, you wretched squish, then what we are doing is actually shriveling the boundaries within which political speech can occur, which means, as a practical matter, that you shrink the ground on which conservative arguments can be made. Now, because Andrew Scheer doesn't think about things like that, he doesn't mind that. Mrs. Thatcher certainly would have felt differently, because she would have understood that it's not like a concertina where you've got like your left hand and your right hand and you're squeezing them in equally toward the middle. No, you're only squeezing the right end. You're shrinking the conservative space. That's what's so disgraceful. Justin is just carrying on his usual old mammy act. But what Andrew Scheer is doing, what David Cameron did when he ordered copies of British news agents to take the names of everybody who ordered copies of Charlie Hebdo a week after the massacre, what people like the so-called Australian conservatives did when they decided to abandon the repeal of Section 18C, they're shrinking their own turf, and they're ensuring that elections henceforth will only be fought on liberal terms and framed the liberal way. Thomas Di Lorenzo writes, or De Lorenzo, Di Lorenzo, De Lorenzo, I don't know. A lot of Americans say D. What was it, Dino De Laurentiis? Maybe that's what I'm thinking of. Thomas De Lorenzo says, do you think there will be any rebound effect among the young once the world keeps humming along after a few more decades of climate change sans apocalypse? I think we're already kind of there, you know. Admittedly, I think that's why they've had to play the Greta Thunberg card and produce this beatific naïf out of the Scandinavian mists, because Douglas Murray described her the other day as a visitation from the Middle Ages. And he was thinking of finding a Danish disabled child a couple of years younger to run against her and go to the UN and say, this climate thing, it's nothing to worry about, it's no big deal. But if the Greta Thunberg card is a sign of complete and utter desperation. And I don't think anybody really takes this seriously. They take it's a boutique issue, and people are happy with it as a boutique issue as long as it doesn't affect the way they live. And the reason it has an appeal among the so-called young is because the young are getting younger. Once upon a time, back when the average American had an eighth grade education. That was it, basically. You were a kid until you were 13, then you were a grown-up. And then they started high school. So you were a kid until you were 18, then you were a grown-up. And then they started university. But it was like compressed, serious university for a relatively small percentage of people who wanted to do serious academic disciplines. And even then, you were supposed to wrap it up by 21, so that the average age at which people got married was 22 or 23. Now nobody can, because you do your stupid course, you've got 6.5 years of college debt, six-figure college debt for a bachelor's you never managed to complete. You're not going to be having a kid getting married and having a kid and moving into your own home at the age of 23 or 24 or 29 or 34 or 39, you're staying at home. And one consequence of that is if you're still living in the bedroom that you've lived in since you were 7 years old with the teddy bear wallpaper and all the rest, you still climb the stairs up to your teddy bear room every night and your mom does your laundry, you're not really a grown-up. You've deferred adulthood. You are Greta Thunberg. And so it seems climate, again, it's a boutique issue with appeal to the young because the young stay young too young. Most of the young are, in fact, incredibly old and shouldn't be young anymore. They should be living on their own. They should be married. They should be having kids. They shouldn't be, yes, Greta Thunberg. Greta, climate change is such a problem. Mom, have you washed my underwear yet? That is part of the big problem with that. But the apocalypse hasn't happened, and I think we're pretty much in the clear on that. James Perrin writes, how is man funded in his legal machinations? This is a reference to Michael Mann, big-time hockey stick loser. As I mentioned, he lost his big case up in Vancouver, and he's being ordered. He's been ordered by his lordship, the judge, to pay Dr. Tim. I shouldn't laugh. I really know I shouldn't laugh. It's rather funny. Poor man. He's Timball's costs, which are going to be a six-figure sum. Now, obviously, this case was dismissed with prejudice because of man's failure to prosecute. If you sue someone, you're supposed to be anxious to get it to court and nail your opponent's flabby butt. That's why you go to court. If you go to court and you don't prosecute your case, you're abusing the process. And that's basically what Mann did in Vancouver, which is why his case got tossed. It had gone on for 8 years. And in that 8 years, there had been over 3 years of time in which there was no activity at all. Mann did nothing. He did nothing to advance the ball, to bring his case to trial. He's now doing the same thing. My case has only gone on 7 years in the District of Columbia. And has he been helped there? Because that court system is a complete choked toilet. But even there, Mann has contributed to the general lethargy of the prosecution of the case. He's saying now he can't be deposed because he's going to be down in Australia for 6 months. I'm happy to have him deposed by some fancy pants silk from Melbourne or Sydney. I'm happy to depose him myself if I happen to be in the neighbourhood. If he's in Cloncurry and I happen to be passing through, I'm happy to depose him in the bar of that Cloncurry hotel where they have the pokies and the forex. I'm happy to do that. But he's not serious about prosecuting. His case got tossed in British Columbia, BC, because he wasn't serious about prosecuting it. So how did he manage to keep that going for all those years? Well, I think it's correct that there are people. There's things called the Climate Defense Fund, which is actually a misnomer, because in all these cases, man is the plaintiff. And I don't rule out that he's getting money from people to carry on tormenting climate deniers. The trouble is, once you lose, as catastrophically as he did in Vancouver, and his lordship says, you got to pony up the other guy's costs, once you've lost and you're a loser and you've got that big L painted on that on your chest, and they don't need to do that with him because they just need to take his hockey stick and invert it horizontally, and it's like an L. So you can just like flip his hockey stick around, stick it on his chest as the big L for loser that Michael Mann is. At that point, you know, it doesn't matter whether you've been getting money from George Soros. The question is whether George Soros, once he knows you're a loser, wants to pay the cost of you losing. And that's actually something quite hard to do. I would say whatever money Michael Mann has been getting to pursue these cases, I would think when it comes to actually paying Tim Ball, he's pretty much on his own. The so-called statement he issued after the Ball verdict which is codswallop on stilts from start to finish. Absolute poppycock from A to Z. That sounded to me, it was obviously unlawyered. So that says to me that that guy is not in communication with his lawyer. That in a sense, the lawyer and the client are not quite on the same page about that. So he's going to be having to pay his own, I think he's going to have to find that money himself. And obviously he's Jessica Alba's personal climatologist. So I suppose that comes with a reasonable stipend. I don't know what it is, but I hope it's enough to cover the poor man's costs. Laura Rosen-Cohen says, "Hey, Mark, what do you make of AOC and the Eat More Babies thing? Does it matter if it was a prank or for real? Or is the real issue what condiments and garnishes to serve?" This, you may have seen, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez was asked by a lady who wanted to suggest that because of the overpopulation of the planet, we needed to actually start eating babies. And obviously, if you know your Jonathan Swift, this is an old-time Swiftian, an old-time Swiftian thing. I think this was something to do. I can't remember where I saw this, but I think it turned out to be a Lyndon LaRouche type person. Was that right? Lyndon LaRouche, one of those fellas, or is it Louis Farrakhan? It's either the guy who goes up once a month into a spaceship to do his numerology shtick with space aliens, or it's the guy who thinks that the Queen is head of the world's biggest drug dealing cartel. It's one of them. But anyway, there's some combination of that and Jonathan Swift led this person to demand from Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez why we didn't eat babies. And it's I don't know whether it'll come to that. Baby back ribs. Have you ever had those? They're made from real baby backs, you know. Did you know that? Yeah, I think they got it. It's like a job lot at Planned Parenthood. They take it out the back into the loading bay and direct to the nearest ribs place. It's actually only possible to talk about the difference between our time and Swift's, which is what makes this more interesting, is that the left does have a more casual attitude now to human life and to the disposability of human life, which is a feature all over the map now, not just in the abortion thing, where they're apologists for not only the Planned Parenthood baby parts industry, but also Gosnell, who was keeping little baby arms and legs in pickle jars as a souvenir, because he liked it. He liked to actually see the jar full of baby limbs, like a jar of pickled eggs on a pub counter in Wales. He liked that. He enjoyed that. Then we have the so-called death with dignity at the other end, where we got the whole euthanasia movement at the other end. You got places like the Netherlands now, where if you're feeling depressed for a couple of days because your cat died, they say, "Oh, wouldn't you be much happier if we just shot the juice in you and you exited this life all very nice and painlessly? Sure, you might get over your cat being dead this time next week. We don't know though. So just to be better safe than sorry, we'll shoot the juice to you and just lie back. I'll get my syringe out and it'll all be over." We are a culture with an ever greater contempt for life. You see it again, this Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez moment. Actually, we have more and more people who are disconnected from families. They are raised in atomized households, and they have, and even if they're not, they have later family formation than they ever did. And when they do get to around to family formation, they have fewer children. So we live in a strange world. Where there are increasingly isolated people for whom humanity is an ever more abstract concept. And if you notice the arguments about depopulation, when the climate guy said to save the planet there needs to be less of us, some of them go the whole way and say there needs to be none of us. There was a big hit book a couple of years ago, imagining a world without us. We're the problem. If you just got rid of us, this would be a pretty nice place to live. But most of them are not quite there yet. Quite there yet. They're operating a more restrictive plan where they're basically saying, if you're like my old friend Alex Renton in The Guardian, he's always making these the arguments they make in The Guardian are that, you know, we need to get rid of us because it's the Western lifestyle that's unhealthy. So you tie your tubes if you happen to live in Cleveland or in Aberdeen or in Ghent. You tie your tubes. It's the people who are in Somalia and Yemen. They're not the problem because they have a carbon footprint that's a 60th the size of ours. This conveniently, this makes no sense with the mass immigration because most of the people arguing for you to have no babies are also in favor of open borders so that everybody, or they want all these people to move in from Somalia and Yemen and develop the 60 times bigger carbon footprint than you have. They just don't want you to have your 60 times carbon footprint. So in a sense, if you're asked, as Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez was about this eat more babies proposal, it actually is quite hard to tell. If you're in her world, where you're talking about, there's like 7 billion people on the planet, there should only be a billion, so who are we going to get rid of? Obviously, Leonardo DiCaprio, he's committed to the environment, so we'll keep him. And then we'll have Michael Mann because he's got his hockey stick. We'll keep Scarlett Johansson because she'll look good in a fur-trimmed bikini paddling the dugout canoe through the pristine wilderness that will exist once we've got rid of all our cities. And it's going to be you guys. You're the ones they want to get rid of. And once that becomes a serious argument, it's not a big step from there to then actually raising issues of whether we shouldn't have cannibalism. So it becomes harder and harder to tell what's real and what's not. We've overrun by a couple of minutes. Tell you what, wait a minute. Johnny B reminds us that in Laura's Links, a Swedish professor has actually recommended cannibalism to control popular growth. And as I said, this is, as Johnny B in fact says, this was Jonathan Swift's modest proposal in 1729 when he suggested that the Irish eat their own children. And now, you guys with the big carbon footprints should eat your own children. Incidentally, if you are troubled, because like you have this ostentatiousness that's out there where people are like demonstrating what they're doing to lower your carbon footprint. If lowering your carbon footprint is that big a problem for you, is that big an issue, just find a fellow environmentalist. And the quickest way to lower your carbon footprint is Pistols at Dawn. Yeah, honestly, that's the easiest way. You lower your carbon footprint dramatically. The two of you, collectively, Pistols at Dawn, you'll halve your carbon footprint. You'll cut your carbon footprint by 50%. That's just a tip from me. If you happen to be in the federal riding of Longueuil on the south shore of the St. Lawrence River in Quebec, our pal and our Mark Stein Club member, Ellen Como, is standing for Parliament as a member of the People's Party of Canada. And I'm sick of the... If say, Scheer pulls it off, and the Conservative Party of Canada emerged as the largest party in the House of Commons in 3 weeks' time or whatever it is, he will have no mandate. He will basically have stood stock still for the 6 weeks of the campaign and said, I'm not Justin Trudeau. And he's hoping that will be enough. And it may be enough. It may be enough. But he will have no mandate to do anything. So he will be yet the umpteenth so-called conservative leader who will be in office but not in power. And if you want something a little more red meat to it, Our pal Ellen is standing for Maxime Bernier's People's Party of Canada in the Longueuil riding on the south shore of the St. Lawrence. And if you run into her campaigning in the street with her rosette, be nice to her, because there's a lot of cranky separatists in that riding. We will have some special news for you any day now about, I think, a couple of events you're going to enjoy, you're going to like the sound of, you're going to want to be part of. And this Sunday, we will have one of our live music editions of our Song of the Week, and I hope you will join us for that. And as ever, we will pick up some of the fabulous questions you asked that we didn't have time to get to, and we will get to them in a special video edition of Mark's Mailbox. So don't forget that. Special news for Mark Sign Club members in your inbox in the next couple of days. If you want to get that exciting special news, you're probably panting, salivating, wondering what it is. It's beyond your wildest dreams, but you've got to be a member of the Mark Stein Club to hear about it. So if you want to join, you will get that exciting special email. And otherwise, if you can't tell with that email, well, still come back and see us on Sunday for the special live music edition of Song of the Week. And as for our Clubland Q&A, it's now 6 minutes past 5 Eastern Time in North America. That is 9 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time. Wherever it is where you are, I wish you all the best, and we will see you next time.